I call the Fool Button.
Welcome to the Fool Button Podcast, where at any time it could go haywire. Now here are your hosts, Jay Surf and Twan.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Fool Button Podcast. Super excited. We have a very special guest. I'm going to hand it over to Twan so he can introduce him.
Hey, how's everybody doing today? So I'm extremely excited today to be able to sit down again and talk with Travis Turk. As you know, some of you listeners out there might know, he was instrumental in the beginning of Jimmy's career. He recorded, he actually did the first recording ever of Jimmy and went on to also produce and engineer both of his next two albums, Down to Earth and High Cumberland Jubilee. So much more to talk about, but Travis, thank you so much for joining us and taking the time on this Saturday to come hang out with Jay and I.
Yeah. Oh, it's a pleasure. Very good time to have, as I told you a little earlier, it's cold here. It's nice to be inside and warm and talking to you two guys. It's great.
Well, we're excited.
It's cold in Jersey too. We actually got about 4 or 5 inches of snow last night. Yeah. And, I had to take out my winter boots again.
Well, my wife is from Jersey, so I know all about that weather.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. So Travis, you know, I know it was kind of back in 1969, but how did you meet Jimmy? Like, did he just kind of come into the studio looking for time, or how did that kind of happen?
Actually, it was back in about late 67, early 68. He was playing at a bar in Mobile where we had our studio, and his wife had wanted to give Jimmy something special, and so she thought about some records to sell or give away. As it turned out, I don't think he sold many of them. I think most of them are in collectors' hands or melted in an attic somewhere. And she came in and put together a deal where he would come in and record some of his songs and so I picked out two songs and recorded the A and the B side of this 45, and so that became the very first record. And it was local musicians, people. I don't think he knew any of these musicians. It's the band that we had at the studio, a studio band, you might call them, So they were fortunate enough to be able to play on Jimmy's first record, and I was fortunate enough to be on engineering it. After that session, I moved to Nashville and started making connections with people in the business. And it occurred to me that Jimmy, you know, might benefit from a really good record deal because I thought he was so good, and had him record I believe 6 songs of his, including the 2 that were on the single. It was just him and his guitar. And basically we got a bite, but the long story is, if we want to go there, is that I invited Jimmy to come up to Nashville and just to see the show, if you will, see what goes on in Nashville at that time in 1968. And so he stayed at the house with us. And at nights, when I had the studio available, I was able to lay down a few more of his demos. And we laid down probably 30 or 40 songs in that period of time. And some of those really stood out to me. And we sort of fleshed them out with drums and guitar, bass, and some background vocals and things like that. And eventually, after doing that, we started pitching those really good demos, good songs, and I found my partner at the place where I was working. I wasn't a partner then. We later would go on to build a studio and become a partner, but at the time we were working at the same studio, and his name was Buzz Kaysen, and I knew he had a publishing company, and I said, "Hey, can I play you something?" And he liked what he heard with Jimmy. But in the meantime, another friend of ours, Milton Brown, also in Mobile, who was also in the music business as a songwriter, was able to finance and bring Jimmy back up to Mobile after that little stay he had in the first time in Mobile in Nashville with me. He financed a deal where he could come up and sing part of the songs, some of his songs on a demo. We did 10 songs with Nashville musicians, and Jimmy sang on that first demo. Milton sang maybe 7 and Jimmy's 3. So we got 10 songs out of that. And those 3 songs and some of the demos we put together and peddled them around and got a bite with a new label at the time. Andy Williams owned it. It was called Barnaby, and he decided he wanted to play in the record business. And that's about what you do. And anytime as you play, you lose a lot of money in the record business unless you get lucky. And he had Ray Stevens. Everything is Beautiful was, the first record out on Barnaby, and Jimmy was the second record out on Barnaby.
And, that's not a bad deal.
Yeah, yeah. So they got a good start. It's just they couldn't get Jimmy going. You know, I mean, there was just it's just not a market for him at the time, or they didn't do it well. Whatever happened, it just didn't happen for him.
Where does he fit, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Especially and, that time in Nashville, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. But we had, we had so much fun cutting that stuff. That going back a bit, the demos that we cut, we would get in the studio and just hammer away at song after song and have fun. It wasn't like a business. It wasn't like, oh, we got to get this done. Or, I hear this song for so and so. It was just fun. It was just total fun. And so we were both growing up in the business. Basically, I'm new to Nashville as a recording engineer, and certainly to the publishing record business. But as it turned out, fortunately for me, I was able to add my name as producer for all of those first songs on the first album and the second album. Just being at the right place at the right time. I mean, I certainly couldn't qualify as a producer of any renown or any that I had done anything that sold or was popular. So we're at the right place at the right time. Took Jimmy a little bit longer to get to where he was going, and I pursued some other areas when we split, and it was just great. But those first albums, to me, like Down to Earth is I'm playing drums on some of those things. We would get into the studio and have fun. I had to be the engineer and the drummer at the same time, if you can imagine that. And what I would do was I would set levels for Jimmy and the rest of the guys that might have been on the session, and I would record a little bit of that, and then I would go out and record a little bit of me playing the drums with him and come back in, make a few changes, and then I would roll the tape back to the top of the head and we would press record. The tape ran for 30 minutes at that speed, and we would just sit and just play and play and play and play until we thought we got one, and we'd come back in, listen to it, cut it out, and do that all over again. And then I would mix. It was 8 tracks at that time. That was the high end of the music business. 8 tracks. Can you imagine 8 tracks on a 1-inch piece of tape? And I would mix those, and that's what became eventually the album, Down to Earth. I remember when we sold the songs to Barnaby. We said, okay, now give us a budget of such and such, and we'll go in and record some, really good, with really good musicians and put more effort and flesh a lot of these songs out better and so forth and so on. Oh, no, we like it just the way it is. No, don't change a thing. I said, what? Okay. You're the record company. And that's what we did. And Buzz Kaysen, who was the publisher on a lot of that stuff and gave me the opportunity to be a producer through his company called Russell Kaysen Productions, later to be Buzz Kaysen Productions, because Bobby Russell was his partner at the time. Bobby, if no one is familiar with him, wrote Honey, Little Green Apples, the night the lights went out in Georgia. He was just a hit songwriter. And sure. But he decided he wanted to go to L.A. and then that left Buzz. And so he changed his name to the, you know, Buzz Kazin Productions. But that was a side trail. That we just had so much fun doing those things that I still have super fond memories of them.
Sure. Yeah. And that first 45, right, was Abandoned on Tuesday and Don't Bring Me Candy.
Yeah, that's right. Those are the two songs that he chose.
I was going to say, and like you said earlier, so, you know, a box of these or a good majority of them were ruined in the heat of the attic out in Mobile, right?
That's what I've heard. In his mother's attic. I don't know for sure.
And the rest of them are in Twan's closet.
Yeah.
How many do you have?
I have two of them.
Okay. Yeah.
So, well, I don't know.
I can't remember if we actually manufactured 500 or 1,000. I would say that with Jimmy's budget at the time, it was probably 500, but I don't remember.
Yeah.
So then that 45 is pretty rare then.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely not more than 1,000 and certainly not less than 500. And who knows how many, as we say, are melted in an attic somewhere. I only have maybe two copies of it myself. Yeah.
And Twan, you have two, you said, in your collection?
I do.
So, Travis, I call Twan the goat of Jimmy Buffett vinyl because his collection, I don't know if he's ever showed you a picture, but his collection is like the craziest thing you've ever seen.
Well, I mean, which I will financially never recover from.
No, you never recover from anything that you're collecting. I used to collect old radio station gear and refurb it and clean it up and just play with it until I got tired of it and move on to the next one. And if I look back now, what did I do? Wasting all that money. Wow.
Yeah.
So, Travis, let me ask you. So when you say you were doing these, you were cutting these demos with him. This is back is this in Spar or is this back at Product Sound?
Product Sound was the first single, and a tape with I believe six songs on it. That was the original demo, if you will, that I used to pitch to record companies and publishing companies in Nashville at the time. So, and then after that, he eventually moved to Nashville and we recorded everything else at Spar, the first album, Down to Earth was at Spar. And at that time, Spar was going out of business and Buzz and I built Creative Workshop and we moved over the production over to Creative Workshop where we had another 8-track. And we recorded the second album there as well, High Cumberland Jubilee. And that one was more traditionally produced, where everything was mapped out on how the songs we were going to do, who was going to play on them, what it was going to sound like, and you know, all of that thing. Totally different than the first album, which was just, you know, just a mishmash of whatever we were having fun doing put together.
I gotta tell you, you know, as a longtime fan, Down to Earth is one of my favorite albums.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. It's I think the level of songwriting, and it, you know, it really has that kind of rooted folk, you know, sound to it. You know, I just look at songs like A Mile High in Denver, you know, The Christian, I Can't Be Your Hero Today. LSD, He Ain't Free. I mean, that's, you know, and even, you know, one of the ballads that, you know, later went on to be re-recorded for Jimmy was The Captain and the Kid. And to me, that's one of his probably strongest ballads, personally.
One of my favorites.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah. I you know, when Jimmy got married in Mobile, we went to the gathering after the wedding. And there was this gentleman staring out the window. It was a second floor ballroom at the hotel he played at. And I walked over, I think, just out of sheer boredom and just said, "Hello, how you doing? What's your name?" And he said, "Well, I'm Jimmy's grandfather. And I went, "Whoa."
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, I was able to meet the captain, you know, which was,
wow.
And it didn't connect until, sure. I mean, years later when he sang the song and when we demoed it and we talked about it, and then I told him about that meeting that I had with him. I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So, Travis, you told me you recorded Jimmy's wedding.
I did, yeah. Yeah, he asked me if I
was.
Yeah, you have a question about it?
Video or audio?
Audio, totally audio. Yeah,
audio.
Yeah, audio. Yeah. Video was not even around for home people then.
So, gotcha.
You know, I think the first ones were VHS somewhere, sometime after all of that, maybe during it, and I wasn't aware of it. But right. Yeah, it was audio, and I placed a microphone right at the altar. This was a Catholic church, right at the altar where they would kneel. And then I placed one on the choir, which was in the total back end of the church, and maybe another one for an audience. I don't recall. And I was listening with earphones and just monitoring things and making sure it all got the tape okay. And I heard this voice say, "Hello, Nashville, here we come." And I look up, and Jimmy and Margie are kneeling there, and the priest is doing his thing, and he sees the microphone, and he just gets way down up on it and says, "Hello, Nashville. Here we go." I'd love to hear tape again. I don't know where it is. Who knows? When they divorced, yeah. I'm sure it got, you know, yeah. Who knows who got the tape.
Right. So going back to Product Sound, so that was the studio that was above the dentist office?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. $50 a month was our rent, and we could barely afford that. The dentist office. We would go in and record in the daytime, and if we got too loud, of course you would. I mean, we're right up on top of a dentist, and we, you know, people playing drums and the bass and so forth. They would take a broom handle and hit on the floor, bang, bang, bang. Stop that noise! It's not noise. Music.
It's music.
Yeah. And so we got relegated to record at night mostly. And then when we would record at night and it would run into the early morning hours, we'd have the neighbors. There were, believe it or not, even in town, there were people that lived above their shops, and that's where they would sleep at night, of course. And the police would come knocking on the door saying, "You got to stop this noise. We've got complaints."
So Travis, I was actually, before I came on here, I was on the phone with Willis Allen Ramsey, the great Texas songwriter. I don't know if you're familiar with Willis, but we got to talking, you know, about our day, and I mentioned we were coming on to do this, and I mentioned Down to Earth, and he was like, "Oh man, I love that cover photo," and yeah. I said, "Well, Travis actually took that photo." So
no, that's not true.
Oh, it's not true.
No. A friend of his named Jerry Wood was an executive at ASCAP, and Jimmy and Jerry made friends. And since Jerry was a photographer, he said, "Let's go out and take some photos." And
Okay.
And that was on that was in Tennessee on the Cumberland River.
It was,
right?
Yes, downtown on the Cumberland River.
Wow.
And were you there or?
No. I'm sure I was in the studio working with someone else.
Right.
Well, I'll have to tell Willis Allen Ramsey tomorrow that I stand corrected.
You know, I don't know where he is now, the photographer, but last I heard he had moved to Florida.
Okay.
And so I don't know where he is.
It's such an iconic photo too, with Jimmy just in this buried car on the side of a hill.
Yeah.
I was told he was drunk as hell.
That sounds about right for early Jimmy.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So you guys have all this demo recorded. You pitch it to Barnaby, you record it. Now, where were you at this time? Have you guys started Creative Workshop already, or?
Let's see. If not, it was very close to it. I'm thinking that was about the exact same time that we opened Creative Workshop.
Okay. Yeah.
So that was out at the, you know, I was going through some Buzz Music recently around the Nashville trip I took, and I came across the Ballad of Barry Hill.
Oh, yeah.
Where you're somewhat immortalized in it.
Yeah. And Travis had a tape recorder, so we made some records.
Yeah. So that was kind of cool to hear after, you know, after talking to you. And just to kind of give a backstory, you know, I was in Nashville over the holidays, over New Year, and it happened to work out. I was going to Travis's house just to pick up a couple records for a friend of mine. And Travis, I'll be honest, you know, leading up to that, I didn't know if I didn't know what to expect. You know, I thought it was going to be a ring the doorbell, door would open about a quarter of the way, the records would be handed out, and you know, and you know, much to my surprise, and not so much after meeting you, but you know, you opened your door and welcomed me in, and we spent close to 2 hours just talking.
Wow.
And it was such an amazing afternoon for me. You know, and I'd brought a box of records just to kind of show Travis some of the stuff that I had. And obviously the shameless, person in me, you know, wanted to get a couple things signed. And also just had some questions on, you know, one in particular that I had that I just didn't know a whole lot of, which was just really cool to hear and get some of the backstory. You know, the one thing that I took out of that, which is pretty funny, when I pulled out the Down to Earth copy I had and mentioned that you had the kazoo credit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you had said, you know, you guys were playing, it was like tissue paper and a comb.
Yeah.
And I think you turned to Jimmy and said, what?
Well, I said, you know, I like this, but I can't, it doesn't sound like I hear it in my head. And boy, it'd be great if we had a kazoo. And Jimmy disappeared and went to a store someplace and found four or five kazoos. And then we, when he came back, we all got into the studio and, you know, that's what you hear.
Yeah.
That's so funny, because when I listen to that album, I love the kazoos. Like, I love it. It's such a nice touch on the sound for some reason. It's just, it works. It's great.
Yeah. Was a lot of fun.
So, you know, one of the other things we talked about, Travis, was, you know, we kind of moved on to High Cumberland, and, you know, I've had this album for, I don't know, 30 plus years, and, you know, always kind of wondered the cover, and you know, it's Jimmy playing the mandolin, and there's a girl and two other guys, guy's playing guitar, and they're sitting in front of a fireplace. And you started kind of mentioning, you know, the people that were on this cover, and then told me a little bit about the Hangout Gang. So what was the Hangout Gang all about?
Well, the Hangout Gang really was more, time-wise, was more a part of Creative Workshop. By that time, I had put together a band for Jimmy, his original band that he toured with a little bit, was two guys from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, and two brothers from Texas, and a third, I can't remember where he's from. There were five of us, and we would hang out at the studio, just play cards, and you know, when sessions weren't going on, and just have fun and hang out, write songs, whatever. And we'd get an inspiration and go into the studio, turn the recorder on, and record something. And I don't know; it's probably Jimmy in his creative head probably named us the Hangout Gang,
right?
So that's how that started. And we played Hearts and Spades ad nauseum. It was just crazy.
And you guys would just hang out at the studio.
Yeah, just drinking coffee and playing cards. And
yeah.
Yeah. It was a great place. Buzz offered a wonderful opportunity for musicians and singers and writers to be able to be in a creative environment, you know, where they couldn't be anyplace else. You know, they not be in a bar or wherever, and just come and hang out and write, create, Creative Workshop.
So High Cumberland was recorded, I think, in 1971 or 72.
That's about right.
And but it wasn't released until 76, after a couple of his next albums came out.
Yeah. There are several stories about that, but we completed the album probably in 72, maybe. and turned it into the label Barnaby, and didn't hear anything. And we inquired, and they said, "Well," they said, "we seem to have lost the masters." And wow. It later turned out, I think it was just an excuse. I think they probably knew they were long to not be in the business, and maybe we're trying to find a buyer for the label. And that's me talking. I don't know who knows really what happened, but so the record, the master stayed in on the vault, so to speak, in their vaults, although we did have copies. And it was eventually sold to someone who invested in all of those masters. And now is the guy that I understand that leases those masters to other small labels. So you'll see, you know, High Cumberland Jubilee and Down to Earth on these just small little record labels or CD labels or however they're, you know, however they chose to sell them.
Yeah, because I think they've been released probably about 12 or 13 times now over the course of, you know, all these years on CD, different versions. Mm-hmm. Some include the originals, some include some additional, you know, songs that weren't on the original record. But
wasn't there obviously a Bear Family release on that stuff?
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
There's a record company in Germany called Bear Family. They do re-releases.
Yeah, so there's actually I have a vinyl of it, a Down to Earth from Germany that I don't know what year it was released, but it has a different cover to it.
Yeah.
But it was the German release of it.
In my opinion, that is the best mastered version of both of those records. A guy in LA mastered them and really did a wonderful job. It was the best sound of any of the other releases that I've heard.
So I'm looking at it right. I'm looking at some things right here. So Tuan, you're right. These re-releases. So we have Before the Salt. It was called back in 79. And then you had Before the Beach, which was 93. American Storyteller, 99. There's Nothing Soft About Hard Times, 2000. And then this company, Delta, Best of the Early Years. And then this last company, or the last name, it says Recall. It's called Now You're Squawking.
It's... Yeah, the German. I'm actually looking at the German one now, and this was actually Janus Records.
Oh, yeah, Janus
is what it has.
Janus was a smaller label in the Warner family. I believe. Let me think about that a minute. Yeah, they actually were not a small record company. They were just a subsidiary of a larger record company, like a Warner Brothers. I don't remember exactly, but my point is that the guy that bought all of this stuff is the one guy that bought everything from Barnaby when they sold their assets. So I'm sure he's doing well.
Yeah. So one of the other records that I brought, or 45s that I brought, you know, I didn't know a whole lot of information on it. There's a little bit out there online, but you know, so I wanted to hear it from, you know, from someone that was probably there. And I pulled it out, and I caught this glint in your eye and this smirk, and it was the suntan, or the sun and the tan band.
Right.
And so I'd asked you about that. So what was that all about? Because, you know, for years it was. There was always speculation that, you know, Jimmy had involvement in it, and then there was other people that said, you know, it had nothing to do with Jimmy. And I asked you, and you said, absolutely, he was, you know, he was part of this.
Oh,
so
yeah.
What was that all about?
Jimmy, Milton Brown, me, and one of the other partners in the studio in Mobile, John Ed Thompson, gathered one night at the studio while we were all in the same town, and I think Milton said, "Hey, I've got a couple of tunes here. Let's just knock them out." And so Jimmy got on bass and guitar, and Milton piano. I got on the drums, John Ed played the tape recorder, and we knocked out these four songs just for pure fun. Like I said earlier, we would go into the studio not thinking about profits or anything else other than just having fun creating something. And we created these four songs, and they laid around, and Milton paid a visit to a guy in Birmingham, I think, and who had a record label, Smartee, I think it was called. And he said, is this something that you'd want to release? And Milton said, well, I guess so. We didn't cut it for that reason, but he released two of the songs on there as they were. We didn't do anything to them. And Jimmy is in that band. I don't think he had any writer's credits. I do not believe.
No, it just has Milton's name on the, under the song title.
Yeah.
And that was Poopy Doo and Bluebird of Happiness, which, let me ask you this. So a couple things I've read out there. So they have the full titles of the songs here, and I don't know if this is true or not, but it was May the Bluebird of Happiness Dump His Load of Happiness on You.
Right.
And the other one is Everything I Touch Turns to Poopy Doo. And then there is a third that says, Look at Them Toe Suckers, Ain't They Sly.
Well, that actually is a song that Milton did not write. That was written, who was that guy? He was on the Smothers Brothers show, played guitar, and he did, he had a hit instrumental record. Da-da-da-da-da. I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, he wrote this thing called, I think it was called Toad Suckers. And it's if you look up Smothers Brothers and Toad Suckers,
it'll
pop up at this guy. I can't think of his name right now, who wrote that song. And Jimmy, that was in his set. And so he said, hey, I got one. And we did that. I believe it's the fourth song.
Okay. Now, the other two songs were never recorded, right? Or never.
They never really
put on a vinyl.
Right.
Yeah.
I still have them in a box somewhere.
the Toad Sucker wasn't Mason Williams, was it?
Mason Williams. There you go.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Okay. Speaking of writing, and just go back to High Cumbie here, is that my all-time favorite Jimmy song is on this album, and that's Livingston's Gone to Texas.
Mm, yeah. Wow.
You know,
great. Berg and White did a string arrangement on that just knocked me out. You know, when those strings come in, my heart warms up.
Doesn't it? And I knew Tony and I were going to be really kind of like soul brothers, you know, because when I asked him his favorite Jimmy song or favorite Jimmy ballad, he said Livingston's Gone to Texas. And I said, man, I've never heard that response from another, you know, person who's kind of into this music. And it's just one of those kind of hidden gems. And it's really cool that it first appeared on High Cumberland Jubilee. And then obviously he went on to re-record that for Living and Dying in Three-Quarter Time. But I think it's one of his best penned songs ever.
Ah, yeah. It's hard to choose a best from Buffett's collection. But everybody does have their favorite likes. And, that and the Captain and the Kid are my two.
Yeah, wow.
So, Travis, I know that, you know, you and Jimmy kind of parted ways after that, and you continued on with your career, and obviously Jimmy continued on. Did you guys in the last, 40 years ever, had you crossed paths quite a bit or here and there? I know when we spoke, you told me you'd have been at the 50th anniversary of the Exit Inn.
Yeah.
And sent me a great picture that you took from that night. Were there times you guys just crossed paths within, Nashville or wherever you guys were at, or was it pretty much, later on that you kind of heard back from him when you contacted him about the tapes that you had or the tracks that you had?
Maybe a handful of times, probably four or five times over those years that we would connect. Oh, the very first time, I had heard that Jimmy was visiting his father, who was in hospice, I believe, in a little town close to Mobile, and I was coming to Mobile about the time that I thought that somebody told me Jimmy was going to be in that town, and there was going to be a street fair. There was going to be singers singing with bands and all of that. And so I said, well, I'll go take a chance. So we went over and we went out into the crowd, and we're listening to this singer, and I look across the way, and there's Jimmy. He's got his hat on, his sunglasses on, he's wearing his shorts, and you know, trying to hide from everybody. And right. And so I just moseyed on over there and got up next to him, and I looked him in the eyes, and I said, Jimmy. And he stood back, and he's and it was like, you know, both of our eyes just popped open. We hadn't seen each other since we parted ways in after the loss of High Cumberland Jubilee. And anyway, we just chatted a minute, and I think one of his sidekicks was with him, and we got introduced and chatted a bit, and then he went on to be back with his father, and I went on down to Mobile. And then there was another time when I was doing a radio show, engineering a radio show called Country Countdown to USA with Lon Helton, and Jimmy was going to be a guest on the show. And Lon knew of my association with him, and I said, hey, guess what? One of your friends is going to be with us. And as it turned out, Jimmy, for no other reason other than that he couldn't be at our studio, said, can we do it over here at the label's office? He said, I don't think I can make it over there and get to my next. And they said, yes, of course. That means that I couldn't be there. But I remember Lon going, he told me, he said, I went in, and before we turned on the microphone, I said, hey, the normal engineer on this show that the studio was going to be was Travis Turk. And he went, and Jimmy said, is he here? And he said, no, he couldn't be here. And he said, okay, well, tell him I said hello. And that was as close as we got until I called him about all of the songs that I wanted to sell back to him for what was to be later Buried Treasure.
Love it.
And I said, well, you know, let's get together and talk about this thing. And he was in Nashville one day and called and said, okay, I'll be in Nashville at such and such. Let's have breakfast and talk about it. And that was a meeting. I think it was another one at a gig. Oh, yeah, two other gigs in Nashville and some other places. And then they that was it. Just maybe a handful of times.
So then that was the start of, you know, like you said, of Buried Treasure.
Mm-hmm.
And these were all the tracks that you guys recorded back in the late 60s, correct?
Exactly. All those demos that didn't make records, and, you know, they were either not good enough and whatever. They just stayed in my collection. I never throw anything away. And they stayed in a box for all those years. And finally, I called Jimmy and said, you know, I can't keep carrying these things around. You need to own these things. You know, they don't need to be in somebody else's collection, and they make money from it. So he said, we'll do it. Well, we'll do it lasted 10 years. And finally, that was the breakfast meeting, you know. And then I gave him a sheet with 100-something songs, and he looked at it and said, wow, I don't remember any of these songs.
Well, anyway, it's phenomenal. I mean, I hope there's a volume 2 or they release those other 100 songs, because he only ended up putting out, what, 10 or 12 songs from volume 1, I think?
Yeah, I was a little disappointed in his decision to do that. I was hoping that there would be, maybe 15 or 16 songs on there that would cover the best of. And,
or even a box set, you know, I mean, that would have been phenomenal.
Oh, that'd have been, yeah. Well, he did mention, I didn't know that he was even thinking about a volume 2 until he let that loose in an interview somewhere. And then I went, oh, okay, well, hey. And I waited and waited and waited, and here we are.
And I got to be,
as we all did, you know.
I got to be honest, I'm still holding a slight grudge for that broken promise.
I've been tempted to call the label and say, look, you know, Jimmy said something about a volume 2. Can we just get together and just, you know, talk about this and get something out there? Because a lot of people want to hear the rest of this stuff.
Well, so, please do. And if you need guys to work on that for free with you, you got volunteers okay. right here, man.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, for sure.
No, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So Travis, so, you know, I don't want, you know, we've talked about Jimmy and everything, but I also don't want to shadow, you know, your career either, because you've done so much through your career. So, you know, I know you left Creative and you went to Toronto for a little bit, correct?
Correct. Yeah. Went to Eastern Sound Studio, world-class place. You know, we recorded the great, probably the greatest album that Gordon Lightfoot ever recorded, called Gord's Gold. And yep. It's got Sundown on it. That was the big record on it, I think. And then re-recorded a lot of his other big hits.
Wow.
And Elton John's Blue Moves.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Anne Murray's stuff. You know, I mean, it was a great place to really work. And but my wife didn't like the weather, and so we moved back to Nashville. So it okay. was it's a great time. And I came back here in I think about 75, 74, somewhere in there.
Okay.
And, you know, of all the years and all the different studios that you've worked at, helped build, so on and so forth, how many different consoles do you think you've worked on in your career?
No telling. every single brand, and within the brand, probably a lot of the different models. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I mean, obviously, it's a learning curve every time you get on something new, correct?
It is a learning curve, but not as steep as you may think, because every console basically has the same, what we call signal flow. It's got to come into the preamp, and it's got to get to through the preamp. There's an equalizer, and then it goes to the volume control, the fader, we call it. And then from there, there's a routing that goes to a tape recorder, goes to a reverb, it goes to the speakers and all that. That's all basically the same, but where they're located and how they sound are different. And that's the learning curve part of the thing that is somewhat difficult. But I didn't find it that hard to learn. When I was an independent engineer where I had to do all of that stuff, there would be somebody on staff that would help out a lot, you know, that say, oh, that goes here and that's supposed to do that. And so I wasn't out there, by myself for sure.
Right. Is there a favorite one that you had or that you enjoyed working on the most, or were they all about the same?
I like Neve. NEVE is a company from London, and they make great sounding consoles. I just always have liked that sound. Although I've always said that it's not the sound. Well, generally, it's not the sound of the record that makes it the hit. It's the song. It's how you make it makes you feel. Sure. Of course, you want it to sound good, you know, for the hi-fi buffs and the people that understand great sounding music. That's great. I understand all of that. But, sure. You know, if the song is not there, I don't care how good it sounds. Most likely it's not going to, you know, I'm sure you've heard trashy sounding records that were hits.
Yeah,
of course. So, of course.
Proves my point.
Yeah.
So sound is your world. What's it like, you know, if you're sitting at home watching a movie with your wife and you guys are, you know, watching, there's a soundtrack playing or something. Are you like immersed in the movie, or are you kind of listening to how things are kind of put together, or, you know, of that nature?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I will watch a movie, and if it's done well, I don't notice anything about the mix or about that microphone shadow or that bad edit, or I don't notice any of those things. But if I see one, I'll start to see another and start listening. I'll get away from the story, which is pretty bad. But
right.
but that happens. And I'll tell my wife, oh man, you know, the volume is too low on the voices. You can't understand the voices. The music is low. And I just do, would you just shut up and listen to the movie?
That's great.
No, that's some funny stuff. So now you're a voice actor. Is what
yeah,
you're.
I was in. I was when I first started in out of high school. I was a disc jockey, and played at radio, worked at radio stations until the last one that I really worked at was in Mobile, And that's when I built a studio with some other friends, and that became a side business, the studio thing. But yeah, so I had a knack, a talent, if you will, for you know, how to talk and recopy and produce commercials and do all that kind of thing. And when I retired from the music business, I really say when I retired from going downtown because of the stupid traffic here, I really got to put into use that talent that I had for voice. And so I just started putting myself out there, and now I do a lot of commercials and industrials. And like I said before we got on the air here, that just last night I was asked to narrate a community orchestra piece, and that was fun.
Oh, that's really cool.
And that's with, yeah, it sounds, you know, when I came into your house and into your back, in your back room there, you know, I don't know what I was expecting as we walked through the hallways going back, and, you know, I walk into this office and there's a huge console sitting on one side with monitors and,
oh, cool,
you know, computer screens, and, you know, you had some cool, you know, Jimmy 45s on the wall. And I believe you had, I don't know if it was a, if it was silver or, but you had a CD on the wall of Down to Earth with, you know, with a record award on there, and, you know, some old, a very old turntable, if I recall, that looked to be about 1500 pounds. So it was just a very, it was cool to step in and see what your world was like.
Yeah, this is my office for sure. Some people call it a studio, and it is a studio in ways, but it's really my office. I do maintenance. I have where you were sitting just to your right was a table that had a lot of electronic equipment on it, soldering irons and screwdrivers and such. And as a matter of fact, I'm working on a speaker right now. I bought a new speaker, and lo and behold, it didn't work well. So I opened it up and started working on it. So I have that. I first started to work at a radio shop when I was in high school. So I have an understanding of electronics. So I still work on electronic things. And so the voice acting and I do video. I had a video company at one time, and there just wasn't enough money in it for me. And because of just too hard to keep ahead of the Joneses, so to speak, when you had to spend, you know, $10,000 for a camera. Every time somebody didn't like the camera you had, I said, I can't make any money, keep buying all this stuff. So, so I got out of that business. So I have a talent for photography and video.
Cool.
Pretty much a lot of the creative arts.
Now, it sounds like it's been an amazing career for sure. Yeah. And you've worked with a lot of well-known people in the industry, which is, you know, probably a byproduct of what you do.
I have. And, you know, at the time that those people came in to do whatever they were doing in our studios, it was just, you know, they were there in jeans and t-shirt. We're there to work. And I never thought about, hey, I'm in here with, you know, some big name. And we're just here to do a job. But now looking back on it, I can understand, and, you know, what you're talking about and how you feel about it, about being with somebody that is a big name that everybody in the world knows. It's humbling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's amazing, Travis. You know, one last question for you. And then we can kind of let you go about your day. How'd the new freezer work out?
It finally came. So, it finally came, and yeah, we're back in business now.
So Jay, that was when I was connecting with Travis before I went to Nashville. He's like, you know, if you want to come by Saturday, it would be perfect.
Uh-huh.
You know, our freezer died. I'm waiting on a new freezer to get delivered. And so luckily for me, he was stuck at home waiting on the delivery. So that was a great opportunity for myself. But you know, Travis, I honestly, I can't thank you enough that those 2 hours I got to spend with you were, you know, I left there on cloud nine. It was such an amazing afternoon.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
He called me Travis after he left, and he was like on cloud nine. That's for sure.
Well, let's do it again.
Hey, we'll I'm in Nashville every year.
We'll get you on cloud 10. One love, one.
Listening to the Full Button Podcast presented by the Songwriters Joint. Follow the Songwriters Joint on Facebook and Instagram for amazing content that features Marvin Gardens and all of his songwriting friends. Let's get together.